What's good, people? My name is Shannon Ross, and this is All In, All Out, a podcast about creating a justice system more worthy of that name, and why you, no matter who you are, should care. All In, All Out is done in partnership with the community, the Wisconsin Decarceration Platform, and the MSOE University Scholars Honors Program. The name of this podcast is All In, All Out, because in order to address the criminal punishment system and improve reentry, we must be all in and go all out. Furthermore, the separation of the system is an illusion, because what happens on both sides of the fence is connected and tied to the same fate. How we treat incarcerated people reflects the state and direction of society. They are all out, and we are all in. As for me, I am just a dreamer who knows there is a better way and is devoted to reaching out and holding on, even when it is uncomfortable, because connections and empathy are the foundations of the types of strong, healthy communities we all want. I spent 17 years in the Wisconsin prison system from the age of 19 to 36, where I acquired my bachelor's degree and wrote a variety of things, some published. I also founded a nonprofit, which I still run, called The Community. For more about our work, visit our website at thecommunitynow.us or click the link in the description below. I am also a graduate student, a business owner, and a first-time father. This week, we spoke to Marlon Chamberlain.
My name is Marlon Chamberlain, and I am the campaign manager for the Fully Free campaign with Heartland Alliance.
Can you talk a little bit about how you got into this work?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So in 2002, I was sentenced to a 20-year federal prison sentence. And in 2010, my sentence was reduced as a result of the passing of the Fair Sentencing Act, which reduced the crack and cocaine ratio from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1. And so as a result of this, my sentence was reduced from 20 to 14 years. And so I ended up serving 10 and a half years in federal prison. And when after I was released on May 29th of 2012, I wanted to get involved because I remember just seeing how excited people were when the Fair Sentencing Act passed, because there was hope. Like, people were excited and were starting to think about the fact that they may, you know, have an opportunity to go home a lot sooner than what they expected. And so that sort of stuck with me, because not only did it benefit me, but I also saw how it benefited a lot of other individuals. And a lot of these individuals were men who had mentored me in prison, who I knew that if they were released from prison, that they would be able to go home and really make an impact in the community, because I saw what they were doing while they were incarcerated and how they impact and influence me. And so as a result of this, I was looking to get involved in like community organizing, even though at the time I really didn't know what community organizing was. But I ended up running into a good friend of mine now, Eddie Boganegra, who was a community organizer working with the faith-based organization. And he showed a documentary. And after the documentary, he went on stage and started talking about how he had spent 14 years in prison, but now he was working as a community organizer to change policy that would impact individuals after incarceration. And so Eddie and I exchanged information, and a couple of weeks later, he invited me to be a part of a legislative meeting with, at the time, the Senate President John Cullerton here in Illinois. He invited me to this meeting, and it was in this meeting that I really discovered the power of like my voice and my experience. And at the time, we were working on a bill that would expand ceiling eligibility. And as a result of me participating in this meeting, but also traveling to the Capitol to lobby and to talk with other legislators, we were able to pass this bill. And so this was a very powerful experience for me because it was like, wow, I played a role in really influencing and helping to pass and shape policy that would impact individuals after incarceration. And so from there, it was a wrap. I really started investing my time and energy, and then I was hired as a community organizer a year later, and the rest has been history.
Awesome. Yeah, that resonates with me, that story about how you find yourself in a situation where you're system impacted for me, it was when I was incarcerated. And I had an article that I was writing. I had been having goals in my mind of just when I got locked up that I'd just write books and make money and just, you know, live high off the hog while I was incarcerated until I got out just as an author. And then, you know, you realize, like, oh, it ain't that simple. Ain't nobody accepting this crap. Like, you know, for one, you're not as good as you think you are. And for two, you've got millions of people submitting articles all over the place. So it's really more complex. And so I had wrote an article for an editorial in the state's second largest newspaper in about 2007 or so. I could be off about that. But there was a legislation forward at the time to have people who were incarcerated get a chance at getting early release before they currently would have under the current process. And I just submitted saying, you know, like, there's all this crap about people that getting out early. The usual stuff they say about, oh, we're going to let criminals out early and it's on the streets. Like, for one, it's people that are like a year or less away from getting out already. Like, what's going to be any different from them getting out a year early? The majority of people that are out of work release right now already at a job, maybe even around the corner from you, could just leave and go, you know, do something that they wanted to anyway. So it's just, you know, ridiculous fear stuff. And so they accepted it. And it was really empowering for me. It was like, you know, they voted on it. It got approved like a week later. And so the thought, who knows what would have happened, but the thought that maybe I had some influence on some legislator in that editorial that I wrote to get that passed was like, it was really empowering. And it was really, you know, invigorating for myself as a writer and as, you know, even as an activist. That's kind of where my life took a toll after that, from writing into getting more into this work. But enough about me. This isn't a podcast interview with me, and people can hear me and talk any day. So I want to get back to you and the work you're doing. What got you into Fully Free? You've had a couple of hats you've worn and a couple of lives you've lived since that moment in the story you just ended with there to getting to now. What was the segue to where you are with Fully Free?
Absolutely. So When I was hired as a community organizer, I was leading an initiative called FORCE, which was an acronym for Fighting to Overcome Records and Create Equality. And this initiative was led by directly impacted people in partnership and working with the faith community. And one of the things that we did was we formed a coalition. It's a lot of acronyms, called the Rocky Coalition, which is another acronym for Restoring Rights and Opportunities Coalition of Illinois. And in this coalition, over maybe a 5 to 6 year time period, we passed several bills that either removed barriers or created opportunities for individuals after incarceration. But each year, we would sort of introduce one bill at a time. And, you know, when we would pass the bill, we would celebrate. But when we would go back to the community, we couldn't see the impact. Like, when we would talk to individuals, we saw individuals still suffering. We would see how people were still being rejected and denied opportunities. And so what we realized from that was that we really needed dramatic legislative action, meaning that we couldn't continue to just roll back one policy at a time. Like, we saw this as an emergency and really said that we needed comprehensive policy change. And so Fully Free was really birthed out of Heartland Alliance, the Never Fully Free report, which really outlined the hundreds of barriers that people face after incarceration. And so as a result of all of that, Fully Free was sort of birthed from our experience and what we really realized around, like, that the community couldn't see or feel the impact of one bill being passed at a time. And so we started thinking about, what if we were just to create something bold that would really go after all of the policies that are in place that restrict people after incarceration. And so that is how Fully Free was birthed.
So who's the organization behind it, the funding and the infrastructure?
So Heartland Alliance is the sort of like sponsoring organization who really sort of spearheaded the birth of Fully Free. And then both of our funders are national funders, which is the Ford Foundation and Arnold Ventures.
Okay. Heartland, is that something that operates in Illinois or Chicago in particular, or are they national as well?
So Heartland Alliance is national. A lot of their offices are here in Chicago, but they also have an international presence. I'm not sure as far as across the country, But I do know that they have, we have an initiative that does a lot of like international work. But they are mainly like focused here in Chicago.
Okay. Is the extent of their work legislative, or do they get into reentry or prison pre-entry, as I call it, issues as well?
Yeah, so Highland Alliance is a huge organization, and they have a lot of this, like this different departments. So there's actually five different entities that make up Heartland Alliance. And so they do have an arm that does a lot of like work around like health in the health industry. We also have a lot of reentry programs. They have violence prevention programs. So they're starting to move more into like the reentry space. As a matter of fact, a couple of years ago, I was actually the community project manager for Ready Chicago, which is a violence prevention. It is a violence prevention initiative that offers an 18-month transitional job, but then also offers cognitive behavioral therapy. And the focus of the program was really recruiting perpetrators and victims of gun violence. And so we worked with the small percentage of folks that are really driving the violence here in Chicago. And it's an awesome program. It's still going on now. And I think they're in year five now. And it was a random control study. So they're now collecting the data from the study to hopefully sort of expand the program because it works. It was a very holistic approach. And a lot of the men that we work with, I think we had like maybe 90% of the young men that we work with had backgrounds. So for me, it was an opportunity to really like see like from a direct service lens, like how these barriers impact people on a day-to-day basis outside of just my own experience and what I went through.
I want to take a quick detour. I want to get back to Fully Free, but I want to ask, you brought up something that's interesting to me extremely, and is a theme of the show, the resources that are available and the groups that are doing this work in Chicago and Illinois overall. Do you find that, as I've heard and we experience here commonly, the theme of siloing and groups not working together as much as would be desired or should happen? Do you find that to be an issue there as well? And if so, I'll leave the second question after that. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. I think one of my early observations was there are a lot of organizations doing great work, but when we would look at like just like where are like the points of collaboration, there were slim to none. So absolutely, that's been an issue. And one of the things that we've been trying to do within Fully Free is to really start to like really bring different organizations across in Chicago, but then also across the state, to say, what would it look like if we were to form a coalition that could focus and maybe have a different focus, but that we would all sort of commit to working together, meaning that we don't all have to have the same objectives of where we want to go. But at the end of the day, like we could all find ways or find places of alignment to say that we could support one another. And then I would also say, too, what we sort of consider a principle and a value of our coalition is that we believe in collaboration over competition. And what I've seen is that there's a lot of competition in this work for funding. And that's a completely different story. But that's sort of like what like drives like organizations to work in silos, because it's almost like this is a competitive environment that people are working in, and people are fighting over the limited amount of resources that are available, which sort of pegs organizations against each other.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I think the funding model is the key incentive for the competition you see. And it's something that, I don't know if this is true, but I have a faith in it, and you can maybe speak to it. But when you pool resources and you put in for these larger grants, and, you know, the funders like to see that, they like to see everybody working together. When you do that, you actually will get more done, and you probably will get more funding by working together than by, you know, trying to go for individual things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I agree 100%.
Do you find from that, though, that, you know, that sounds fantastic in not theory necessarily, but just saying it. But then when you get down to actually working together, you know, the egos come in and the different ideologies come in. How have you found dealing with that? And when it happens, what has been a good solution to, you know, get past it and not let it destroy the collaboration?
So I think for us, we spend a substantial amount of time really building relationships. And for us, that's first and foremost. Like, you have to spend time and really build meaningful relationships before you begin to work together. And then what we also do is we create a conflict plan to say, if there's tension or conflict happens, we have a way that we have an agreement on, like, how we'll sort of deal and resolve conflict. And ultimately, if it gets to a point to where that conflict cannot be resolved, then we look for alternatives to say, like, okay, maybe this isn't a good fit, because, like, what we all agree to when you join the coalition is that these are the principles and the values. And if someone breaks the principles or values, then there's a conflict plan in place that also includes, like, more of a restorative justice sort of, like, approach to trying to resolve the conflict. But if that doesn't work, then I think at the end of the day, and this hasn't happened yet, so I'm just saying, like, I can't say from my experience that I've seen this happen, because in most cases, because we did the relational work on the front end, we're able to resolve the conflict as it happens. And then what we also try to do is to name, like, where do we see, like, potential conflict and tension? So we sort of put that out there on the front end as we build relationships. And then also, like, the vision that we cast for our coalition is really around a collective leadership model, meaning there is no one person that's bigger than the group. And we believe that everyone that's a part of the coalition is a leader. And so when you show up, the expectations is that you show up as a leader. And if somebody retires or moves or transitions to a different job, the movement continues, because that is the model that we're really sort of, like, cementing as far as, like, really building out this collective leadership model versus one person being, like, the leader of the coalition.
Yeah. Was there a model that you took from another place to do that, or did you guys kind of organically just put it together?
No, absolutely. JUSA, okay. When I participated in their year-long Leading with Conviction training in 2019, and that was one of the things that they talked about, like, conflict is going to happen. And so they talked about creating a conflict plan. But one of the core principles of JUSA is really around a collective model. Their vision and goal that they had was to cut the U.S. prison population in half by 2030. Mm. And that vision, there are organizations and individuals across the country that are a part of their network. And so they really believed and sort of cast this vision of a collective model where you can have leaders across the country really lead this work. And so we just took what we learned from that training and applied it to what we're doing now.
Yeah, shout out to Glenn Martin, of course, for getting that going.
Absolutely.
In the early stages.
Absolutely.
Would you have, is there anything that you would say for groups like ours here locally who are trying to get similar, I think, around the country? You have different states. When I talk to people in different locations, it's the same solutions they're trying to solve, the same approaches, the same, you know, different levels of progress towards these goals. Would you say there's anything right now that we could contact or read or just do to kind of better situate our collaborations that we're working on as well?
Yeah, I would say something that I've really been adamant around, even in my work with Fully Free as I travel around the state, is that, like, when I show up in different cities, I don't show up and leave with Fully Free. Like, I don't show up and say, hey, come support this great campaign, and then that's it. What we've talked about is, like, how do you really center people with lived experience? Because we hear that term, but mm-hmm. when you start to ask folks to really define, like, what does that mean in practice? And so what we're doing and how we sort of see like how you center people with lived experience is if you can picture a circle and picture people with lived experience in the center, but surrounding them are resources. And resources could be anything from funding to office space to whatever. And then also surrounding them is training and leadership development. So we're bringing trainings in different ways to help develop leaders. And then there's also community support, which could be from the faith community. It could be from reentry organizations. It could be from academia. But that community support really sort of like wrapping their arms around these individuals and really supporting them. And then the last spoke that I would say would be exposure and a platform. So as we develop leaders and we provide them the resources and the tools that they need to do this work, we also want to give them a platform so that an exposure so that they can be heard and seen and people could see how we're developing leaders. And the point of this is really to build an infrastructure that supports this work. Because in most cases, we're sort of forced to join like other like tables that may not necessarily be friendly towards us. Meaning I've been in a lot of policy spaces where if you don't know the lingo or the jargon of like policy, like you'll find yourself sitting there like, I don't know what's going on. And so what we've decided is how do we create our own tables that are sustainable and can really support the work of activism from a directly impacted person's perspective. And this is what we believe works, that if you invest in sort of creating this infrastructure, that whatever issue you bring to the table, people will support it, and then you'll have leaders that could actively lead this work. And our thing is really around just activating people. And if they want to join Fully Free, great. But if they start showing up at voting registration drives and they show up to town hall meetings and now they're a part of some sort of civic engagement, like we consider that a win. And so I would just say, in this work, we tend to lead with issues, but we're looking at, like, how do we build this infrastructure to support activism so that we can develop leaders to become activists for their own liberation?
Wonderful. So I'm going to get back to Fully Free. I want to dive in a little more about what that looks like. I know you had come in with the FIRE organization that we were working on. I don't know where that's at, but... mm-hmm. to, you know, address the issue of rights restoration nationally. So is this, where are the limitations and what are the details? I mean, there's a lot of questions I have in there, but I don't know where to start. Is there anything that you can give me because you've talked about it a little bit, but a general idea of, well, what does it look like on a daily basis? And is there anything that you're not fighting for when it comes to rights restoration?
Absolutely. So here in Illinois, well, let me first start nationally. There are over 50,000 collateral consequences that currently exist that really hinder people with arrest or conviction records. Specifically here in Illinois, there are hundreds. Initially, we sort of named 1,189 sort of like barriers that people face after incarceration. But as we continue our analysis, what we're learning is that a lot of those were duplicated. And so there are still hundreds, but it's not 1,189. And what happens is people with records like me are told, you know, to rebuild their lives after incarceration. There's without help. And in most cases, individuals are returning to communities with limited resources and then have to navigate these complicated sort of web of laws or state laws that restrict individuals' rights. And these laws intentionally deny individuals opportunities for employment, housing, occupational licensing, and they create this prison after the prison, and they follow individuals for the rest of their lives. And that's why we decided to call them permanent punishments and not collateral consequences, because collateral suggests that these laws are accidental, and we don't believe that they were accidental. And so if you really look at like the background of the background check industry, or you look at like the number of employment and housing opportunities that are really governed either by background checks or licensing, this is where like all of these sort of laws hinder people. Because if I want to go apply for a license and I have a record, I can't. Or we've even discovered recently that if you are a convicted felon, you can't be the administrator or executor over a family member's estate or will. So a lot of these laws that are in place, like, really hinder people from really flourishing after incarceration. Yes, anybody could go work at a warehouse, but if you have hopes and aspirations of going maybe into, like, the medical field, which is one of the fastest growing industries here, like, there's barriers where in most cases you can't if you've been convicted of a felon, as a felon. So when I just think about, like, in its totality of, like, where these laws, like, currently sit, it's almost like they create a ceiling for you to say, well, you can go do this and you can do this, but if you really sort of want to, like, follow your dreams after incarceration, there's a limited amount of, like, as far as employment or housing of like, what you can do. And even in Chicago, there are maybe 8 communities that 40% of the individuals who return from IDOC here, they go back to. And these are communities that, as I said, have a limited amount of resources, but then you add this web of laws on top of that, and it's almost like you're forcing people to make decisions that could ultimately lead them back into incarceration.
So do you address each one individually to fight, or is there a kind of grand bill you're looking for to have rights restoration?
Yeah. So our strategy as of right now, we're waiting until we're currently sort of still analyzing the Illinois, like, statutes and codes. And we're sort of halfway through that process. But once that process is completed, that's really going to determine, like, what strategy we decide to use to introduce either maybe sort of like a comprehensive, like, legislative package, or if we decide to introduce several different legislative packages. But this is a multi-year campaign. And so next year for us is an election year. So there's a governance race next year. And so what we decided was that we're going to introduce sort of like what we're calling low-hanging fruit, which could be, an example could be making amendments to the law that says that if you've been a convicted felon, you can't be the administrator or executor over your family member's estate. We may introduce something that we believe both sides of the aisle would support even during an election year. And then in 2023, we would come back and look at introducing something larger or more comprehensive that we could introduce. So even like right now, our goal is really to do a lot of base building and building relationships across the state, educating people around what are permanent punishments. In Illinois right now, our data estimates that there are 3.3 million people in the state that are impacted by permanent punishments that have an arrest or conviction record. And the 44.1% of that 3.3 million, well, 44.1%, we couldn't track the outcome. So we believe that 3.3 million number is higher of individuals who are currently living in the state of Illinois that are impacted by permanent punishments. And so we want to go out and mobilize that sort of demographic of folks to get involved in this work. And then the second part of our work is around narrative change work. And then the third bucket is introducing and passing legislation to eliminate these permanent punishments.
Very cool. Have you found, so for me, it's how long are you into it? It's pretty couple months.
Yeah, we officially launched the campaign on June 23rd of this year.
Okay.
So we're still like in the beginning stages of building everything out.
How have you found the terrain so far? I mean, there are different, you know, you have the base who gets it, and then you have when you get beyond the base and it's like a whole different ballgame. How have you found the messaging and the reception of this issue?
So I would say for the most part, people have been receptive and sort of shocked because they didn't realize like the number of permanent punishments that exist. But then that's also been sort of like which is expected, like the opposition of folks who believe that past criminal behavior is a predictor of future behavior. So we've heard sort of like the naysayers who believe that once you commit a crime that you should be punished for the rest of your life. But I would say for the most part, the reception that we received has been good. But like I said, just being a realist, like we expect people to come out in opposition and to say that once a criminal, always a criminal. Like we expect that. But for the most part, people have been very receptive to the campaign and want to get involved.
Okay. What has the narrative change, or as we say, narrative correction work, looked like so far? What is the strategies you're using for that?
So as of right now, we're still building out our narrative strategy. But I think one of the things that we've done as we travel around the state, like wherever I go, like we have two or three people that travel with me and we're all directly impacted. And so when we show up and we have these different launch events across the state, like people are shocked at the fact that like, wow, you have a record and she has a record. So I think even in that, that's a part of like our narrative change work, even like just centering people with lived experience. Like we have a governing board that is comprised of all directly impacted individuals that really is around like narrative change, because like I don't know if I've ever seen like a governing board where you have all directly impacted people that are really sort of like helping develop the strategy and leading the campaign from the top to bottom. So we haven't fully developed like our narrative change strategy, but so far that's some of what we've done. And then we've also the June 23rd, the launch event that we had, the virtual launch event, really highlighted and showcased like the talent that directly impacted people have. So the whole program was led by directly impacted people. The MC discovered his gift of being a comedian while he was incarcerated. So he was the MC and facilitated. You had different folks that King Musa, who's a rap artist. You had Augie, who did time, who's an artist who drew like some art to really give like a visual message of like what it means to be fully free. So the whole platform was really led by directly impacted people. But we're still in the process of really developing like what our like narrative strategy will be to change the narrative.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like what we're doing with our award show coming up on November 10th, where every aspect of it is system impacted. Is there anybody else that's at the high level of running the campaign with you, or are you in charge and everyone else is kind of being directed by your guidance, your leadership?
No, so we have several chapters across the state. As the campaign manager, I'm sort of like just the quarterback. But we have leaders in Carbondale, or we have all directly impacted leaders across the state in Carbondale, Aurora. So we have like what we sort of call like our fully free, like point person in each like different city across the state. And so as I travel around, or if somebody reaches out to me and wants to get more involved and they live in the southern part of Illinois, then I would redirect them to our contact person who's in that area. And each one of us are working to really build out like our region. And so in the southern part of Illinois, we're working to really organize and build out a table in that region of the state. In the northern part of Illinois, we're working to really build out a region. And then in the central part, so we're hoping to build out 6 different regions across the state. And each one of these regions has a contact person who's like the lead, like liaison for fully free in that respective region.
Okay. When you go to these places, how does it look to get people to come to hear about the story? Because, you know, clearly these are areas you're trying to reach people that don't really know. You're not offering reentry resources necessarily. You're just trying to tell them a story that they need to hear. How do you get them in the door? What is the promotion like for that?
So what we do is we have, first it starts with relationships. So it starts with Zoom calls with individuals, and we sort of start mapping out and scheduling a date for the launch event. And then we build out a turnout plan. So we look at like all of what we look for, all of like the reentry organizations that's in that area. We reach out to them to let them know what we're doing. We reach out to the faith community, churches, any churches, mosques, whatever. We reach out to them to let them know what we're doing. We reach out to different colleges. Anybody that we believe has an interest and would be willing to support, we sort of create a list, and then we designate, okay, who's going to reach out to who. We also reach out to the media, so we help create, we provide a toolkit, a media tool or communications toolkit that also includes like a sample press advisory, so that we send out something to the press. And hope that they come out so that we can amplify like the message of what we're trying to do. So we have like a plan of what we do. Like this week, I went to East St. Louis, and this trip was really to build relationships. We sort of had lunch together with like 10 or 12 different stakeholders. And then every week from starting next week, we meet weekly to sort of check in on where we are with turnout. Okay, who's going to do what? Who's bringing out different resources? Because what we would do is have a press conference first, where we have local leaders sort of talk about how permanent punishments have impacted them. We invite different elected officials to come out that are in support of the work, and we would give them a minute to speak about the importance of this work. And then after the press conference, we move more into like a community event where we have different, like just different agencies come out with resources that they can offer the community, whether it's like employment opportunities, housing, COVID testing, COVID shots, whatever. We sort of like look at like what agencies can we bring out that could help also support and provide resources to the community during the community events.
Do you find that with that approach, you get a lot of people who are already really open to it before they come in? Or are you like, I'm always wondering, how do we get people that are not super far from the issue, because you're not going to reach everybody, but how do you reach people who are reachable, but just are not going to be brought in by their church or by somebody they know? Like they're far enough away that we need to find some other creative ways to reach them. Is there any kind of approach there, or do you find that that's not even worth the energy or resources?
Yeah. So the first step is really establishing like a fully free chapter. And then we haven't reached the point yet, but we're close to where like the East St. Louis launch event is the last one. That'll be 12 cities in the state. And the follow-up plan is that now we're going to start traveling the state and having that conversation. Like, how do we get in front of or get in the room with people who may not necessarily, like, agree with what we're saying? And so right now, like in the work that we're doing now is really educating the public, but we also want to see, where is there like potential opposition, and then where's the audience that just doesn't know, and how do we reach them? So I think phase two of what we're doing in the work will really be around like, how do we begin to like reach that group or demographic of people that are not going to come out, that maybe they don't attend the church. And how do we reach them? So we haven't reached that point yet, but I think as we like finalize this last launch event, like that's what we're going to shift to.
Okay. The overall argument, what do you tell people that think that they don't care about this issue? What do you tell people that feel this is something that doesn't impact them? They don't live by areas that are, you know, more populated by system impacted people. What has been the messaging you've used and that you found effective?
So a lot of times we use the fact that if there are 3.3 million people in the state of Illinois with an arrest or conviction record, somehow you are impacted. Your neighbor could be impacted and you just don't know it. But somehow you are impacted because that's a lot of people that have an arrest or conviction record. And then second, I would also say that as a taxpayer, Like, you're paying for someone to be incarcerated. And the work that we're doing with Fully Free and removing these statutes, we're not asking the state to give us any money. Like, we don't need to go through, like all of our work does not call for the state to invest money into anything. This is simply removing barriers. And because if people come home and they end up back in prison, which the recidivism rate is around 40 to 43% here, like, you as a taxpayer are paying for someone to just sit in prison when we could use that money to really invest in communities. And so those are sort of like the two like responses that we would give. But I think because we're still new, we're still learning, like, how do we develop like the Q&A and the questions or the responses to people who would say I'm not impacted in any way. So we're still new. So we're still learning and just thinking about, like, how do we sort of develop those responses so when we hear that, we can respond in a way that will hopefully sort of motivate and engage someone to get involved.
Yeah, in my experience so far in that regard, and it's nowhere near, I think, the level of outreach that you all have done. We do things and events and try and get out because our focus is, as you know, we've talked about this before, where really a similar alignment with trying to, you know, address the narrative as a core issue. And what I've found is that things that resonate are, there's a 95% of people getting out. I mean, that, you know, finding things that are not political, that are not ideological, that are not religious, they are very much pure problems in society that need to be solved. And so keeping it at that area, I think, is always the safest. And the 95% of people are coming home, so you can't run from that. It's happening. It's been that about number for decades, probably, for how many get out. And they all have a massive price tag that you've already paid and that you continue to pay. So what is the return on that investment? You know, if you want to take it away from, we're doing a mixed media video right now with animation and some live action. And so just trying to find ways to bring that concept to life of having like a price tag. That's like a tail, just wagging and slapping people. Like it's you know, you need to start feeling it and seeing it because it's around you. You're not even just aware of it because you're ignoring it. And so focusing on those two. And then, like you said, you know, 1 in 3 people have a record. That's a common statistic. It's much more nuanced than that. 1 in 3 people have an arrest record. A felony record is more like, I think, 16 million in the country. But you don't know what anybody's background is. You don't know what anybody's mentality is when you meet them. So it's lazy thinking to go from, oh, okay, I don't know you, and you, but you have a criminal record, so I'll right away disregard you. And the other ones I'll give a chance to. But the person you're disregarding is very likely to be equally, if not more, ready and safe and mature to, you know, be in your life than the three who maybe have not had that experience in the contemplative environment, the humbling nature of, you know, facing what it means to be in prison and all that stuff. So there's this, you know, how do you break down that really complex understanding of to be system impacted and the potential there and the gravity of personal development that comes from it into a soundbite? You know, like, how do you get that digestible is the question that we are facing in this work, I think.
Absolutely.
Well, I greatly appreciate, again, you spending some time with me to talk about this. And I hope that we can get some stuff up here similar. I hope to learn from what you all are, you know, achieving and finding out down there and using best practices. And anything I or the group here can do, please reach out. You know, we have a pretty decent network that we can try and spread. And we're an hour and a half away, I think, in Milwaukee. So,
absolutely. Let's do it.
What Marlon is doing with the Fully Free campaign is what our goal at the community is in Wisconsin and anywhere else we can help proactively correct the narrative. By going to communities we call beyond the choir on this issue and showing them that they have only been seeing part of the story about people that have criminal records and the ineffectiveness of prison and the overall carceral state. A very small and misleading part of the story at that, not even a good summary. We believe there is an untapped empathy in whiter, wealthier, more conservative areas, just as there is an untapped potential in people with criminal records. And there is an equal humanity on both sides that leads to criminal behavior in the one and criminally destructive perception and bias in the other. Both sides dig in their feet with 100-pound bags of should and shouldn't that keep opportunistic businessmen and politicians happy and full in between them. I was surprised to encounter opposition at the beginning of this work from those in the reentry reform decarceration community because they felt they shouldn't have to show basically white people that they are human beings deserving of empathy and respect and opportunities. I thought this was an interesting and very relevant reaction to the idea, but I nevertheless found it to be too reactionary. For one, it makes enemies of people caught up in the same process of cause and effect as system-impacted people are. Again, they come to their biases the same way those of us being discriminated against for a criminal record come to break the law, life events, human nature, and history. For two, this strikes me squarely as the exact same as the traditional counterproductive view of people with criminal records, the view that society shouldn't have to help them because they broke the law. Which leads me to three. There is no such thing in life as what should be. There is only what is, and what can and is being done about it. And I believe and walk and struggle in this belief every day, that if we use different strategies in conjunction, we will have the best outcome for the stronger communities everyone wants. Going to those that don't get it and don't understand that they are actually endangering themselves and their loved ones by neglecting those that are the easiest to disregard is an integral part of the strategy. I want all comers on this issue who sincerely disagree, because difficult conversations require both sides, and it's the comfortable separation that is hurting us most in society. So please challenge me, but please challenge yourself equally. Thank you for listening. Peace.